Jacksonville mourns the loss of a local legend, former mayor Jake Godbold. Yet another committee is created to investigate the JEA mess. And should the voters pick Duval's school superintendent? Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, we speak with comedian Rita Rudner as she plays the Florida Theater next week with a friend of hers, Louis Anderson. That's coming up later. But first, it is Friday, and yes, it's been another very busy week in the news. So we're pleased to welcome Nate Monroe with the Florida Times-Union. Good morning.
Morning.
Tim Gibbons of the Jacksonville Business Journal is here.
Good to be here.
Giorgio Valentino, editor at Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
And freelance journalist Claire Goforth.
Hi.
Hey, guys. So good to have all four of you here with us because there is, as there is every week, a lot to talk about. Everything from the deepening investigation into JEA to a new hire with the Jaguars and more. But we're going to begin this hour with the passing of former Jacksonville Mayor Jake Godbold. Godbold died yesterday at the age of 86, and his passing is being mourned across the city. He rose from a very poor childhood on the city's north side to become one of the modern era's most influential political leaders. As just one example, Godbold was instrumental in bringing an NFL franchise to Jacksonville. And just months before his death, he was still out there continuing to advocate for this city. In particular, Godbold fought hard against the sale of JEA. Here's a clip from his last appearance on this program. It was August 6, 2019. He called into the show to talk about the JEA scandal.
I don't believe it's necessary. There's challenges to all utilities these years, but we have the wrong person. I think everybody in town knows that the wrong person is over there running JEA, a person that I don't know, and I don't personally say anything, but he's not qualified to take us through this period. And it is a trying period of time. But we need somebody over there, and there were people that put in their application that was very, very, very qualified. This man was not qualified to take us through this period of time. He was put there to do what he's doing, and that is to put JEL for sale.
That's the late Jake Godbold. He was talking about the now fired CEO of JEA, Aaron Zahn. And as we kick off the roundtable, what are your thoughts and memories of former Mayor Godbold? 549-2937. Nate Monroe, you wrote a nice column in the TU that is live this morning memorializing Godbold's contributions to Jacksonville.
Yeah, he cared for the elderly. He fought for minorities and poor people. He oversaw one of the most vibrant, active periods in downtown's growth in the city's history, and you know, was just a really vocal champion for Jacksonville his, you know, his entire life. There wasn't much not to like about him.
He had a really colorful, charismatic personality. He also really, I think, the times I would interact with Jake, he was a throwback to an earlier era of politics. He was sort of the last of the so-called Dixiecrat politicians in this city that used to be a lot more common in the South. Tim.
It was. I mean, he definitely was a character from his time. It's interesting. Nate mentions the interacting with minorities and basically the all of Jacksonville. We talk about one city, one Jacksonville now. And if you look back on Mayor Godbold's career, he embodied that. The idea of, you know, he put in the city's first minority contracting ordinance in a time where it really wasn't a popular thing, and, you know, led to a lawsuit, appointed the first African-American members of several city boards. So it was a reaching out in a time that was probably even more difficult than doing so is today.
That's right. He had always very strong African-American support. He had a coalition, Claire, that you don't see as often today in this city.
Yeah, it's a shame that we're so polarized as we are now. I mean, looking at Jake Godbold's legacy, and I have to say I had the misfortune of never meeting him in person, but reading his words and seeing how that he just would go right at the issue. He never shrunk from it. He would just say what he thought. And as he aged, you know, people tend to think that you just sort of go go out to pasture, and that is definitely not what happened with Jake Godbold. And I think I join everybody in Jacksonville saying that, you know, we're grateful that he blessed us with his life and his legacy, and our heart goes out to his family and to the people that loved him.
Giorgio, you know, shortly before Godbold died, he was on a panel of former mayors along with current Mayor Curry at Jacksonville University, and he made them kind of uncomfortable talking. He had a tendency to do that, to make his other fellow mayors uncomfortable, because he was so vocal. And he criticized the way consolidation in Duval County failed to live up to its promises, particularly for poorer and African-American citizens. And then right up until his passing, he was fighting as hard as he could to prevent the sale of JEA, as we heard on this from that clip. He was on the show just a few months ago talking about it.
Yeah, as a recent transplant, I wasn't too familiar, except with this recent activity, especially the JEA sale. And I found it refreshing to hear people speak with respect and admiration of a politician, especially in these days where there's so much distrust, which is well-founded. And so I thought it was kind of heartwarming to kind of feel that. And now that he's passed, I think it's a good time to reflect on the things that we've been talking about, this kind of bygone era. But let's also look forward to a time where we can recapture a little bit of, I don't know, some kind of unity.
Right. He did bring people together, and I think people liked him because they just could tell he was authentic. There was no artifice to the man. If you didn't always like what he had to say, you knew that he was sincere.
He was also really unafraid to be the only voice on something if he thought that it was the right thing to do. And I think in this city, where there is a really long tradition of powerful people just abiding injustice and cruelty with silence, like I thought that that was a really nice part of his legacy, and just remained a refreshing thing about him.
Right. He wrote an op-ed that ran some months ago in the Times Union, railing against the attempt to privatize JEA. And he said in that piece, "Why am I all alone here? Mm-hmm. Why isn't anyone else speaking out?" And then it seemed as though after he did have that published, that more people started to come to his side.
He's pushed back. Obviously, JEA is the most recent thing, but there was, you know, other situations, the cuts that would have affected or the safety net hospital, UF Health. He wrote columns, articles, basically pushing back against that for that same sort of reason. And it had the weight of his history. You know, he was instrumental in basically turning JEA around. When he was mayor, JEA was not in great shape. And he's actually credited with kind of bringing it to a utility that the city could be proud of. He helped bring UF Health into what was then a kind of foundering hospital, you know, dealing with issues. So he brought that in. He also did, you know, he attracted Mayo here. He got the landing here. So he had
the Jaguars.
Right. He had the credibility of having gotten stuff done, you know, that he could then stand out and say, this shouldn't happen.
Well, and he was mocked for his enthusiasm mm-hmm. for bringing a football team here. You know, another...
Well, until it happened, right?
Sure. Well, but isn't that... People, that's what leaders do, right?
People thought it couldn't be done. Right. But he led from the front, and that's the difference between right. Jake Godbold and some of the leaders we see today, is that they sort of lead from the pack, right? They wait to see which way the wind is blowing, and then they go in that direction. Jake Godbold really just, he grabbed the wind and ran with it, and everybody followed him. I mean...
Yeah, there was a kind of fearlessness that I
courage.
Think... And courage that people, and authenticity that people respond to, that they kind of, as you said, Giorgio, they wish we could see more of in our political class. And so let's take some calls now, as the big story of the week is the passing of former Mayor Jake Godbold. 549-2937. Let us know your thoughts. Mark on the West Side. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning. I met Mayor Godbold many times, and he was a very nice person, and he would write you back, and he would call you if you had a question, on and on and on. I knew him when he was a city councilman, too. But, you know, let's not forget, you know, you shouldn't speak ill of the dead, you know, my prayers go out to his family. But, you know, we've been mocking the landing for about 20 years now, and he was shameless in bringing Rouse down here to to build that. I mean, he gave them just everything they asked for. That, you know, the thing with the football team, he brought, what's his name, Urshay down here. And even at the time, and I remember it well, it was kind of seen as, you know, just too much. And when the Jaguars were thinking about coming down here, we were negotiating with Tom Coughlin, not Tom Coughlin, but God bless, you know, all the owners and everything. He was right in the back, just shamelessly, you know, I talked to him about this. He would have given up his mother to get that team here. And you know, there's a lot of people in town that don't think the Jaguars are a good idea for this city, and for many good reasons. And he was just shameless. And, you know, you look around at the growth. He was very pro-growth. I mean, next time you're stuck in traffic, you know, you say a prayer to Jake Godbole, because he was instrumental in all that, bringing a lot of businesses. He was very instrumental in the Jacksonville Economic Development Commission. And so, you know, he was a nice guy, and you hate to see, you hate to speak ill of the dead, but, you know, anybody who thinks Jacksonville is growing too much and too big and too fast, and we give away too much money to these billionaires to build things and bring football teams here, he's responsible for that.
All right, Mark. Thanks for the call.
I mean, anybody who's in public life is going to have detractors, and there's certainly, you're going to make mistakes as well. And that's a fair point.
Well, I think it points to one of the things that over the years I've kind of had a hobby horse of a division between what people want Jacksonville to be. And it's a perfectly valid and good question of, do you want the landing, you know, a successful landing? Do you want a football team? Do you want more traffic? Do you want to grow in that sort of sense? There are plenty of people who moved here because they don't. They don't want to see that. And that's the question. What should Jacksonville be? And I think Godbole, you know, bringing Mayo, that
yeah, he,
you know,
clearly was swinging for
you would have
big
thought.
Big wins,
right?
You know, and it's kind of interesting to think about that he's passed away the same week that the landing is now completely rebelized. That was one of his big accomplishments, and as you know, with the passage of time, things come and go, as we've seen.
I was talking to former Mayor Delaney yesterday, and he said something to the effect of he thought that the JEA thing would basically keep Jake alive until, you know, it came to a conclusion, just because he was, you know, he'd be waiting to see what happened there. Maybe it was the landing. Once the landing was gone, he was like, eh, okay.
Time to check out.
Time to check out.
Anna in Avondale. Go ahead, Anna.
Hi. One area that hasn't been discussed yet, this is Anna Dooley from Greenscape.
Oh, hey, good morning.
Jake was way ahead of his time. He was very involved and very committed to preserving our environment. I know he founded the Keep Jacksonville Beautiful Commission. He has always been very active in trying to save parks and make the city a greener, cleaner place. I was honored by the commission to receive the Jake Godbole Award. And to me, it wasn't so much about my achievement, but the fact that he had been able to do all that he did to make that even come about as something where environmental work was recognized. So he needs to be remembered for a lot of the greenery that we see and for all of his efforts that he did in that regard.
Anna, thank you. That's Anna Dooley of Greenscape. Thanks for that as well. Another important legacy. And if you're just tuning in, it's our media roundtable, 549-2937. As we talk about the passing of Jake Godbole, we want to move ahead and touch on some more important news from the week. As we mentioned, he fought the sale of JEA right up until the end of his life. And the deepening investigation into the JEA scandal had so much news this week, it almost makes your head spin. Now, I know we talk about this on the show almost every single week, but that's because it remains so incredibly newsworthy. There is so much to talk about here. This week, the City Council created a committee to investigate the aborted sale. The City Council auditor pushed back on JEA's claims of a death spiral, saying they misrepresented that. The city's Ethics Commission says it needs to strengthen its oversight powers in the wake of this scandal. And there's more. St. Johns County says it's going to move ahead with an attempt to break away from JEA's water and sewer services. Nate Monroe, did I cover it all? Have I missed anything?
But by all means, let's terminate Aaron Zahn without cause.
Which could still happen, right? That could still happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you did cover it all. Yeah, I don't even know where to start or what to say.
Okay, let's let's start with this. Let's start with the city council committee that's going to, we are being told, have subpoena power to investigate the attempt to sell JEA.
You know, I appreciate the spirit that's going into that, and I do think it's important that there be some public examination of what went on. Because, you know, the feds are never, if no one ever gets indicted, the feds don't like write a report that says, here's what we found. They don't say.
Yeah, we'll never learn about anything.
Yeah, they just go quiet. They don't say anything. So I do think that's important. I do wonder how effective this committee will be in issuing, say, subpoenas to people. I don't know what lawyer would tell their client to go, yeah, sure, go testify to a public committee. I do wonder about roadblocks that they'll run into, but I'm glad that it's happening, and I think it's a good thing.
Let us know your thoughts about the latest headlines into JEA 549-2937. Now, what about this, Giorgio? On Thursday, we learned that the city auditor said JEA's top brass were purposely giving misleading information to make it look as though the utility was in a death spiral that would justify the sale. The auditor says the facts just don't show that.
Yeah, and I think everyone sensed that when we started seeing that propaganda roll out last year. Just to go back to the investigation real quick, what I'd be worried about is that the mayor might have too much influence in the council. Federal investigation has its drawbacks, but at least it's, in theory, independent. I hope they start from scratch and not continue the state attorney's investigation. There were questions of conflicts of interest that the state attorney had sharing political consultants with the mayor. So what I would be worried about is folks trying to insulate the mayor from responsibility in this. They will find patsies. They'll find fall guys. They're going to throw people under the bus. A lot of people suspect this goes all the way to the top, and we need to know if that's the truth.
Claire.
And full disclosure, my husband works for JEA.
I'm glad you pointed that out.
It's great that the city council has named this committee, but my question is, where were you guys 6 months ago, 3 months ago? You were just sort of watching all of this unfold while everyone else seemed to be pretty horrified by the way it was playing out and were just going along with it until it became an untenable issue and you had to do something. I mean, congrats that you're doing something, and we're going to learn more, hopefully, depending on what happens. But, you know, in going with that, the Ethics Commission obviously does need some more oversight.
Let's talk about that. The city's ethics director, Carla Miller, has really been a hero in all of this, performing oversight, although that body says they really need to strengthen their oversight powers. Miller, and correct me if I'm wrong, said that she was not sure she would even be allowed into the sessions in Atlanta.
She was barred from them.
From the sessions in Atlanta where JEA was entertaining offers from potential private bidders.
So the Business Journal's editorial this week, I just find interest in the timing of it, basically took the tack that the council auditor's office and the ethics office desperately need to have more resources given to them. If you look at the public servant heroes in this, obviously the Times Union reporting in particular brought a lot of this to light, but the people who were paying to provide oversight did a tremendously good job when they were able to do so. And the idea of taking those offices and giving them more resources, it's really easy for politicians to say we need accountability, we need transparency. Giving those offices more resources would help a lot in doing so.
I completely agree that the silver lining to this entire debacle has been seeing the checks work. They did exactly what they were supposed to do.
Different checks.
Lots of those been
checks as in checks and balances is what you're saying.
Speaking of checks, interesting tidbit. As of Monday, Aaron Zahn has made as much while on leave as the median Jacksonville family household income.
He's been on leave for what now? Several months?
A month.
And he's 34 days. He's pulled in more than $70,000 in pay from JEA. And so the big question, Nate, is will this board terminate Zahn with or without cause? Will he get a golden parachute? That's what clearly the public doesn't want, the city council doesn't want, Will the board?
I mean, if Aaron Zahn has some good dirt on people in writing, I think that he gets that without cause. If he doesn't, maybe they'll fire him with cause. I mean, let's be real. There's got to be emails and text messages that he has that can really point the finger at some people that maybe have not been exposed, as Giorgio was saying. People who have been insulated. It's possible that he may be holding something as leverage.
I think, you know, the Office of General Counsel is conducting this, and so I air quotes, investigation into Aaron Zahn's tenure as CEO. And they've extended the amount of time that they're taking to do that investigation. They would look like fools if they found nothing, and the board would look, you know, ridiculous if they fired him without cause while JEA privatization is under a federal investigation, while a city council has formed an investigative committee.
By the way, here's a tweet from Lisa. Remember last year or in 2018 when a council committee having subpoena power was called the worst idea ever? So just throwing that in, but go ahead. Finish your thought if you could.
Yeah, I just, even by the standards of this town, letting Aaron Zahn go without cause would really be absurd.
What about this too? And by the way, it's 549-2937 to join the show. St. John's County says it now wants to negotiate with JEA to purchase the utilities assets in St. John's County, essentially break away from JEA to purchase the part of the utility system that delivers water and sewer service to about 35,000 St. John's County customers.
This honestly would be funny if it wasn't serious. I mean, the idea of they open up this, we're going to sell. County gets the first right of refusal. Okay, no, we're not going to sell. We still want it.
We still want it. Right. I mean, so if you're a St. John's County JEA customer, you're looking at this, I would guess, and just shaking your head, wondering what the heck is next.
And this whole process has cost the taxpayers so much already, and it's opening the door to just more litigation and more money wasted, and it just goes back to the original sin that this was just a terrible idea, and somebody thought they could just get it done real quick and just muscle through, but they got stopped.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think St. John's County really has a leg to stand on this. I mean, you have to have an offer and acceptance. There's going to be the acceptance. JEA has flatly said they're not going to sell the water and sewer. But this also goes back to the death spiral, and they're in so much trouble. If it was so bad, people wouldn't want to buy it. I mean, that's just realistic.
We mentioned the council auditor's report. There was another memo that came out this week from a law firm called Nelson Mullins. This is a firm that interviewed to be sort of an advisor to the city council and JEA staff. They weren't picked, but they did make public their due diligence review of JEA's privatization, and it echoes the city council auditor's findings that the numbers JEA was presenting to regulators and the numbers that they were giving to the board and to the public were different. JEA made a regulatory filing over the summer that told the Public Service Commission they expected about 5% higher electric sales by 2028. Aaron Zahn told the board of directors he expected an 8% decline in electric sales by 2030. I think that is a serious problem. And something that this council committee, if they were looking for a good thing to start with, I would start there.
When we talk about terminating for cause, and Zahn's argument has basically been he was pursuing privatization because that was the will of the board, arguably not, but that you can't fire somebody for cause when they're simply basically doing their job. But that gets to the root of the idea that if he was providing incorrect information to the board, he was not doing his job. It's also, you know, from the Business Journal standpoint, we've looked at the stuff that JEA told people buying its bonds. You don't lie on those. I mean, that's even worse than, you know, getting investigated by a city council committee when the SEC comes after you. So,
and what about the failed what about the failed bonus scheme? That more than anything riled up the public and the city council, the perception that especially the top brass at JEA were seeking to enrich themselves to the tune of millions of dollars with a questionable bonus plan that would happen in the event of a sale.
and meanwhile churning out propaganda, you could call it, lies, you could call it, in order to make the case for that sale. I mean, when does a lie become a crime is a question that a lot of people have been asking lately, and I think it's one that the feds are also looking at hard.
I mean, the thing is, when people say that government should be run like a business, I think they typically mean well-run, nicely functioning businesses, not, you know, WeWork, which seems, you know, AG isn't here to rail about late-stage capitalism. But I mean, that's kind of the idea that JEA executives seem to have was, you know, we're here, it's a huge business, and we should be getting more money out of it, which isn't the typical way that
That's not how most public servants view their role. So that, of course, that's why it was so incredibly controversial.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the irony is that if Zahn pulled the stunts that he's pulled with JEA at like a real publicly traded corporation, I mean, he would be out with cause, you know, facing some sort of litigation by the company, maybe in trouble with the SEC over these filings. I mean, to me, that's the real irony.
Would he be up Poop Creek without a paddle?
Okay.
You could say that.
And if you're just tuning in, it's our slightly potty mouthed media roundtable. Giorgio Valentino, Claire Goforth, Nate Monroe, Tim Gibbons, and yours truly, as we talk about the biggest stories of the week. We're going to move ahead now and talk about a bill that would let the voters decide on electing rather than appointing a superintendent for the Duval County Public Schools. State Representative Jason Fisher proposed this change, and his bill did pass out of a committee in Tallahassee this week. The legislature is in session right now. Fisher says the voters should have a say on the local school's chief. Now, there are elected superintendents in other districts in Florida. However, most large urban school districts like Duval County appoint their superintendents. The reason for that is it's a complex job. Educators and school board members say it requires a national search to find the best person. They also say this role should not be politicized. Do you think that the Duval School Superintendent should be appointed or elected? Call us up, 549-2937. Giorgio Valentino.
Yeah, I hate the way that the language is being discussed. It's less about empowering voters and more about chastising the school board. This is about taking power away from the school board because the school board is the only remaining independent kind of body in the city at this point that City Hall has not kind of slipped its tentacles into. And keep in mind that this bill was first proposed in its ever-changing form. It was first proposed during the school board referendum kerfuffle, and it was a way of distracting and punishing the school board for having the temerity to propose a referendum that the City Hall and powers that be didn't like.
And you're getting SAT words on this show, like blazing fastballs.
That's what I do.
Which is great. Claire.
You know, we haven't really talked about the fact that to run for office in Duval County, you have to be a resident of Duval County, and that would apply to a superintendent, one would assume. And as to what Melissa said about the top most populous counties, actually, I did the math yesterday, and only two of the top 20 most populous counties in Florida elect their superintendent, and none in the top 10.
Which counties are those?
Oh, you know what? I didn't write that down, Melissa, so...
That's okay. We'll look it up.
I'll tweet it after the show.
But for those that like this change, they're pointing to that. They're saying, look, this is done in other school districts. Why can't we do it here? A UNF poll said a majority of Duval County residents would like the chance to vote on a superintendent.
Yeah.
Mike Binder, though, said anyone will say they want the chance to vote.
You know what voters would also support if they were asked in a poll? If you ask voters if Jason Fisher deserves an atomic wedgie, they would say yes in overwhelming margins. So
you've met him.
This argument that we should put something on the ballot because people would like to weigh in on it. Like, okay, let's put consolidation on the ballot too.
Well, I mean, that is, if you ask anybody a question that starts, would you like to vote on, and you're asking voters like to vote. I mean, it's kind of part
sure.
of the job description. But the idea that not weighing on the merits of it, but if we're saying that a superintendent needs to have certain skills, the idea of saying that a person in Duval County who can marshal enough money to run for election has those skills is kind of a stretch to me.
And, you know, we spoke about this yesterday with another journalist, Emily Block of the Times Union. As she pointed out, the backstory to this is when you sort of peek behind the curtain of this legislation, Giorgio, there's a battle for control of the Duval County public schools going on between traditional public school advocates and moneyed interests that are in favor of more school choice and more funds and influence going to the charter school movement. Mm-hmm. And this bill should be looked at through that prism, quite frankly.
Yeah, exactly. And again, the context was the school board referendum. When Jason Fisher first drafted the language, it had nothing to do with an elected superintendent. It had to do with an appointed school board. It was a more overt punishment of the school board. And then at some point, Mayor Curry said, no, I think it should be something a little bit more like an appointed or an elected superintendent. And then the next day, by chance, Jason Fisher reworded his bill and made it all about an elected superintendent. But, I mean, the end result is the same. It's a way of putting the school board in its place and being able to then use public funds for privatized for-profit education.
Yeah, and if this does get on the ballot, then you know who else will be on the ballot? Jason Fisher, who, based on what he has done in this whole saga, has drawn a challenger. Ben Marcus was running against him, correct? Ben Marcus doesn't have very much in his campaign account, but the Florida Education Association really does dole out a lot of big checks around the state come election time. It is possible they could jump in this because they've historically tried to support public schools and pushed back against the movement to have more charter schools and to give them more of the public money. There's a chance that race could heat up.
Here's a tweet from a listener. Until more than 7 people vote in our local elections, the superintendent should not be elected, he says, making a joke about the low voter turnout we tend to see in this community that's in an off-year cycle anyway. Let's go to Susan in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. I would like the panel's take on, I was at the committee meeting on Wednesday, and Representative Plankton, the chair of the committee, said that the state legislator has the authority to place things on our city's ballot. And there has been a number of preemption bills being proposed in the state legislature as an attack on home rule. And if they start using these local bills to attack home rule, I find that very scary. So that's one of the issues that worries me about this J1, because the local bill manual actually says that local bills are not supposed to do anything that can be accomplished at the local level. And putting this on our ballot could be accomplished at the local level. So what do you think about that? Are they going to use this J1 bill as a template to start other attacks on home rule? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
I do think that there is, especially in light of the litigation between the school board and the city on the sales tax controversy, I do think there is a legal question about whether the legislature can put this on the ballot. I mean, the rationale is that because we have a consolidated government, that supposedly there's something in the state constitution that says the legislature can change parts of our consolidated government. Well, we have a local judge who has now said that the school board isn't really part of that consolidated government in the way that city lawyers have traditionally understood it. Our school board operates just like every other school board in the state, and every other school board in the state, it's up to the board to put this question on the ballot, not the legislature. And so I do think that is an issue. And
there's been no legal challenge filed yet, though. Yeah, but that does raise an interesting legal question.
It does.
Okay, one more big item from the week. Jay Gruden has been hired as the Jaguars' offensive coordinator.
See, that position should be voted on. Offensive coordinator should go up on the ballot.
Let the ticket holders decide. Okay, so this is happening as fans cite concerns about the recent news that there could be not just one, but 2 home games in London this year for the Jags. Here's an email from Joe we got yesterday. He specifically asked we talk about this on the show today. He says, I have been a season ticket holder since the mid-2000s. I am extremely disappointed to hear another report of the Jaguars possibly moving a second home game to London. This is crap that this is even being considered, because the franchise was awarded to Jacksonville, not London. I will be canceling my season tickets if a second home game is announced. And if I can't be given a clear answer first, I will not renew. What do you think about this? 549-2937. Claire Goforth, it's my understanding you've been a season ticket holder since the first game.
No.
How long have you been a season ticket holder?
10 years.
Oh, only, okay.
Only 10 years.
Only 10 years. So as the super fan here in the crowd, what are your thoughts?
A second London game, people are going to be extremely angry about that. I mean, the ticket prices go up and you get less games to go to. And I mean, the fan experience has really gone downhill in the Shad Khan era, in my personal opinion. You know, but football's a business, guys. Yeah, they like to win games, but they like to make money more. And that's really what this is about. I think that Jay Gruden will fit right in because he's coming from Dan Snyder's football team, which is also great at making money and not good at winning football games. So, hey, it'll be a comfortable transition for him, and I do wish him a lot of luck. But, you know, it comes down to this question. Can Jacksonville support an NFL football team? Do we have enough of a fan base? Do we have enough population, enough interest to really keep a team here? A lot, you know, a season ago, two seasons ago, everyone was saying, yes, of course. But is that true? Is that realistic?
I think the best response on social media was from the Jumbo Shrimp, who tweeted out that, well, all of our games are going to be played at home.
Nice.
Yeah, so their social media game is strong. But yeah, what about that question? I mean, we're the smallest NFL market other than Green Bay. Green Bay, those fans are the most dedicated NFL fans you will ever see. They literally show up in the dead of winter and shovel off the seats in their stadium from snow. You know, it's a different kind of town.
They had to stop paying them in checks to shovel the snow off because they wouldn't cash them. They would frame them, and it was creating such an accounting issue that they had to start paying them in cash.
That, I think that shows you the level of fan That's right. intensity that they have there. We don't have that here. And so, you know, as they play over in London, on the one hand, people are saying, well, that's exposing us to a global audience. It's exciting. It's interesting. But, you know, as we look at all of this, also in the context of the Lot J development that Shad Khan, the owner of the team, is very close to getting vertical around the football stadium. You know, there are a lot of threads to this story.
Moving a second home game to London is unacceptable and should be a total non-starter for the city. I mean, that should just not be allowed to happen.
Maybe we should change it to the IFL, the International Football League.
But who's going to stop them?
Usually in a negotiation, there are sentient human beings on both sides of
which
the
you don't
divide.
Seem to think we have here.
No.
No, I mean, even Curtis Dvorak, the former Jacksonville mascot, long time, so talented as a mascot. Wow. I mean, I've seen him in person in that costume, jumping out of airplanes, was railing against the idea of moving a second home game to London on social media yesterday.
But this is in keeping with a long tradition of most NFL cities. The NFL owner says, this is what I'm going to do. Here's my flaming hoop. And the mayor of whatever town says, I will jump through that flame.
How many
hoop.
Millions of dollars should I bring with me?
But so I think, Melissa, one of your earlier points of the, you know, you look at Green Bay and the rabidness of its fan base, and obviously few cities can compete with that. But I do think there's an appetite in Jacksonville to be that sort of fan base. You know, we started all of this out talking about God Ball and bringing it here and the excitement around that. And, you know, you talk to people like Claire, longtime season ticket holders who, you know, still stand by the team even when the product on the field isn't that good. This is the, at least kind of, this sort of move, though, moving a second game to London would be seen as so much of a slap in the face mm-hmm. that there'd be no hope. I mean, honestly, you might as well move them all there at that point because people would abandon
and
the team.
And why do it unless your long-term plan is to, what's the rationale for doing it?
I mean, why? The rumor is they want to move to London. The date I hear is 2022, but I don't know if that's true.
Giorgio.
I generally recuse myself from all discussion of sport.
Okay.
But I'll just say it sounds kind of funny. I mean, I don't know if it's best practices. It sounds stupid to me to play a home game in a city that's not your home city. But that, I know nothing about it, so that's just my outsider's opinion.
All right. Let's move on to some other topics then. Finally, before we go to break, it's our lightning round. There it is. Stories we've been following from the week that might have escaped wider attention. I'll start. A pair of Jacksonville City Council committees passed recommendations this week by a state-mandated task force on sea level rise. The three big ones are expand boundaries to reflect the city's unique interconnected coastal system and adapt implement rather adaptation strategies to plan for storm and flood risks. They also want to hire a chief resiliency officer for the city and do a vulnerability assessment to look at our unique vulnerability to water coming in via storms, flooding, and sea level rise. That's a big development that we'll continue to follow. Giorgio, what else caught your eye this week?
Well, I'm looking forward to next week when we at Folio Weekly announce the winners of our Best of St. Augustine Reader Poll.
Oh, very nice. I bet that was a spirited contest, too.
Always.
Yes. Claire Goforth.
Last night, Congressman John Rutherford held a sort of town hall light in Nocatee, which is something very rare for him. I think that shows us how serious he's taking this race against Democrat Donna Deegan, who's challenged him for the seat. And I think we're going to see a lot more interesting news cycles that come out of that race.
That it wasn't open to the public, right? Only residents of Nocatee.
I mean, they're part of the public, aren't they?
Sure. But now you couldn't come if you weren't a resident.
Right.
Still,
no,
he had a real back and forth with the people there.
That's what I heard.
Nate Monroe.
I think I will be stuck in the JEA foxhole for the rest of my life.
Nothing
to offer.
Nothing new to offer. But, you know, I know it's been said a lot. The reporting you and your colleagues have done on this story has been outstanding. And it really, I think, turned the tide and was instrumental in stopping the sale, which the public clearly was overwhelmingly against. So
thank you.
You're very welcome. Tim.
Downtown parking, some interesting stuff happening there that the DIA is looking at changing different meter technology, different ways of basically trying to attract people to the urban core. So it's fascinating.
Very cool. Well, you can read about that in the Business Journal. And I want to thank all four of you for always volunteering your time to come in here and engage with our listeners on the biggest stories of each week. Thank you, Giorgio Valentino, editor at Folio Weekly. Journalist Claire Goforth.
Thanks, Melissa.
Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union.
Thank you.
And Tim Gibbons, editor at the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you so much, guys, for being with us this Friday. We're going to take a quick break, but up next, comedian Rita Rudner is coming to town. She'll be on stage with a good friend of hers, Louis Anderson. The show is called He Said, She Said, a preview of all the laughs coming to the Florida Theater next week. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
So we would get both sides, and the opposition would come out just as strong as people that were for us or trying to figure it out. But they're Iowans, so they would bring hateful signs, but they wouldn't hold them up when I was speaking because that would be distracting.
Join us next time for True Stories Told Live on Stage in Iowa City. The Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Ahoy, I'm Chris Thiele, host of Live From Here. Each week we bring you a live broadcast featuring incredible musicians and comedians, and the party keeps raging after we go off the air. This week we've pulled together some of our favorite, never-before-heard performances from encores, warm-ups, and even some studio sessions. Tune in to hear this special episode from The Vault.
Saturday evening at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. In serious accidents, first responders can now reach the families of over 17 million Floridians. Have you registered your emergency contact information?
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
Cypress Village, a continuing care retirement community, features resort lifestyle amenities which allow residents to remain active and vibrant. The new alternative to long-term care insurance, 901-4004. More at lifecare.brookdale.com.
Jacksonville Country Day School. Through intellectual exploration involving project-based and transformative learning, JCDS prepares pre-K 3 through 6th grade students for success at the next academic level and beyond. More at jcds.com.
Open house on February 4th, 9:30 a.m. I'm Peter Sagal. This week, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me goes to Iowa to make fun of political candidates to their faces, or at least as much of their faces as we can see under their parka hoods. Join us for the news quiz from NPR.
Saturday morning at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Abortion and parental consent. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
This Friday, the Florida legislature is considering a bill that would require teenage girls in the state to get parental consent for an abortion. We'll take a closer look. Also, why the state is putting together a task force on sea level rise.
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Friday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
A week of political drama on the main stage.
This for that.
And in the wings.
Major sleazebags. They're very dishonest people. Very, very dishonest people.
The impeachment trial of the president takes center stage. But what else happened this week? I'm Todd Zwillick. It's the Friday News Roundup. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. He said, she said. That's the title of Rita Rudner and Louis Anderson's new show coming to the Florida Theater next Thursday night. I recently spoke with beloved comedian Rita Rudner all about it. Rita Rudner, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Here I am. I'm in Florida.
I know. We're excited you're coming to the Florida Theater. You'll be performing on stage with another comedic great, Louis Anderson.
We've known each other for 700 years now.
Oh my gosh, so the two of you together, that sounds like a great night. Tell me about the rapport between the two of you guys on stage.
Well, we have a lot of rapport backstage. That's even more important because they always give us two dressing rooms and we always end up in the same dressing room.
Oh really? So good friends.
Yeah, because we can't, well usually it's Louis because he has better food.
And I'm not surprised to hear that.
Yes, and he's very generous, too, and he lets me take whatever I want, and we always sit there and we talk because we've got so much history together. But as far as our acts, the reason we go together so well is we're both clean acts, and that's what we are. And it's not like, oh, I'm not like a prude where I go, oh, no one should swear. I think everyone should do exactly what they want to do. But when you're being paired with another comedian, it's important that we have the same kind of aura and frames of references, and that's why Louis and I work together so well.
Is it hard to stick to that in this modern era? I mean, you've been doing this for decades and so successfully, and you've had the same persona throughout. Is it hard sometimes, challenging?
No,
or
that's
do you find
just
it works?
Me. It's hard to do something else. If I would do something else, it would be false. And the one thing that I've learned in my comedic notebook is to be yourself. And the minute you try to be someone you're not, it shows, and people don't believe you. So if I don't believe what I'm saying, and if I don't think what I'm saying, and if I don't live what I'm saying, then I don't think people would respond the way they do.
When people come to see your show, what are some of the comedic themes that you get into?
Well, I have to get into being married for 31 years.
That's always fun.
Yeah, I have to get into being the mother of a teenager. I have to get into not understanding technology. So, you know, there's a lot there. Just those three things.
Those three things are
funny.
Hours
and hours of fun.
I can relate to all of them. And you
see
know
what I mean?
Yeah.
I can relate to how silly women are and how strange men are. I can do all that.
Now, as a woman in comedy, tell me about that, too, because you started in a time when there weren't a lot of women in comedy.
Well, there still aren't that many, and it's a very strange, I'm really glad I did it. I don't know why I did it. I said I was in therapy. I forgot to ask. But what it is it's a position of power, and you manipulate people's feelings. You have a microphone. You stand there, and it's a very powerful position to be a comedian. So I think there are a few more female comedians today, but there's certainly many, many, many more males than females.
And do you think that still some audiences just aren't comfortable with a woman having the power position?
No, I think people are comfortable, much more comfortable than when I started. Because, like, when I started, you couldn't even have two women on in the same night. They'd go, oh, we had a woman on the comedy club, you know, the stage tonight. We don't have another one. And now women can, you know, they don't think like that. And a woman could even follow another woman on stage. But, you know, they would never think anything of a man following a man on stage if there were two comedians. But, it, you know, it's, maybe that's still almost a rarity. But definitely men are much more self-aware. They're much more accepting, and it's a much more open world.
Sure. Now, in addition to all of your success with comedy, you're also a successful writer. You have written several well-received books. You and your husband produced a film script, Peter's Friends, which I loved.
Yes, and we wrote it, and I got to be in it.
And you were in that movie.
I wrote a part for myself.
That's right. That was a great movie. And you also collaborated on a play. Do you plan to...
Yes, we just did a play in New York. It was fun.
Do you plan to continue writing?
Absolutely. We like to do lots of different things. I'm doing my stand-up now in lots of places, and when I go home, I start rehearsals for a play that I'm doing Barefoot in the Park at
nice.
A theater, and because I love Neil Simon, and I'm really excited to be doing this play. I'm playing the mother of the bride in this really, really wonderful play, and I'm reading the script every day because I'm not a quick learner, so I got to start really early in the process. And also, my daughter is a singer-songwriter, and it's fun. Sometimes Martin and I are her roadie, and we carry her equipment around, mm-hmm. so that's fun. And then she's auditioning for lots of colleges in the music program, so we're involved in that. It's lots of different things, but definitely Martin and I will write something again.
What a multi-hyphenate you are. Well, it's a pleasure to speak with you, and we're so excited for your show coming up here at the Florida Theater with Louis Anderson. Rita Rudner, have a great time, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to being there, too. I'm going to be wearing a pretty gown. Everyone should come see. It's going to be sparkly.
That's Rita Rudner. She'll be on stage with Louis Anderson next Thursday night at the Florida Theater. Get your tickets at floridatheater.com. That's our show. Thanks so much for listening. And be sure to tune in today at noon to our statewide live call-in show, The Florida Roundup. We look at a new abortion bill moving through Tallahassee and efforts to create a statewide task force on resiliency and sea level rise. That's at noon. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. Have a great Friday. We'll connect again very soon.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.